From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 42 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, researchers at the National Institutes of Health have found that more than 50% of the current asthma cases in the country can be attributed to allergies, with about 30% of those cases attributed to cat allergies. Wally Akinso has a report on how pregnant women who have very low cholesterol levels may face a greater risk of delivering their babies prematurely than women with regular cholesterol levels. That's according to a study by the National Human Genome Research Institute. And on the subject of preterm birth, extremely low birth weight premature babies who received breast milk shortly after birth had greater mental development scores at 30 months than did infants who were not fed breast milk. That's according to a study funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. From the In Case You Missed It file, an interview from back in June with Dr. Julia Rowland, director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute. But first, Wally has a report about new online resources stressing the importance of calcium for bone health that are now available for middle schoolers through the Milk Calcium Education Campaign, sponsored by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Got any young scientists at your house? Bring them to SciLife 2007, Saturday, October 20th at the L'Enfant Plaza Hotel in Washington. Take advantage of this opportunity to meet scientists and medical professionals. Learn about careers in science and health. Learn how to write a top-notch college essay and where to find cash for college tuitions. Lunch is provided, and it's all for free. Log on to science.education.nih.gov, print the application, and mail it to Cheryl Moore, NIH/OSE, 6100 Executive Boulevard, Suite 3E01, Bethesda, Maryland, 20892-7520, or fax it to 301-402-3034. Make plans now to attend SciLife 2007, Saturday, October 20th, at the L'Enfant Plaza Hotel in Washington. Welcome back to NIH Research Radio. Wally Akinso has this report about some new resources available, stressing the importance of calcium in a child's development.
New online resources stressing the importance of calcium for bone health are now available for middle school teachers through the Milk Matters Calcium Education Campaign, sponsored by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. The campaign encourages 11 to 15-year-olds in particular to consume sufficient calcium because these are the years of rapid bone growth. According to Dr. Karen Weiner from the NICHD's Endocrinology, Nutrition, and Growth Branch.
The Milk Matters online lesson resource is really support to teachers. This can provide evidence-based messages about the importance of calcium for bone health in adolescents. And it just provides a lot of different ideas for teachers to incorporate into their lessons.
Milk Matters online lesson resources are designed to help students understand the importance of making smart food choices. Dr. Weiner talks about some of the many features that the site has to offer.
They have take-home assignments. There's a cookbook, which I thought was interesting. They teach concepts, how to read nutrition fact labels. You know, if they go into the supermarket, they'll understand how to choose foods that are high in calcium, and then just to understand which foods are high in calcium and what is needed for this age group, which is approximately 1,300 milligrams a day. So those are the basic resources that are provided there.
In addition to teachers' materials, the Milk Matters website offers a variety of free materials for parents and healthcare providers that emphasize the importance of calcium in the diets of children and teens, including a booklet, poster, fact sheets, a coloring book, and a sticker. So teachers and parents, if you would like to check out the website, visit www.nich.gov/milk. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Researchers at the National Institutes of Health have found that more than 50% of the current asthma cases in the country can be attributed to allergies, with about 30% of those cases attributed to cat allergies. Researchers at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases determined that 56.3% of asthma cases are attributed to atopy, a condition that results from gene-environment interactions. Dr. Daryl C. Zeldin, a senior investigator at the NIEHS, said that sensitivity to cat allergens appears to be a strong risk factor for asthma in this study, but that some research shows that exposure to cats, particularly in early life, may be a protective factor.
What we're looking at here in our study is current exposure to allergens and current asthma symptoms. That said, there's certainly a significant literature out there that suggests that early exposure to things like cats and dogs and farm animals is protective, and it's thought that it leads to the development of a tolerance or an immune system that's less likely to be allergic.
A positive skin test reaction to cat allergens accounted for 29.3% of the asthma cases, followed by 21.1% for a fungus known as alternaria and 20.9% for white oak. Dr. Zeldin said there are several implications to be drawn from the study.
First is that if one can somehow prevent the development of allergy to cat, alternaria, and white oak, then a significant percentage of asthma cases could potentially be prevented. The other way to look at the coin is that although 50-plus percent of individuals have asthma that can be attributable to this allergy or atopy, that means that just under half of asthma cases have a non-allergic etiology. In other words, their asthma is not related to development of allergy. And I think that we and other scientists are trying to figure out what other things may be causing or exacerbating asthma in the indoor environment. And I think there needs to be further research in this area.
The study is available online in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. When we return, we'll discuss the challenges that face cancer survivors with Dr. Julia Rowland, Director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute. That's our In Case You Missed It interview, next on NIH Research Radio.
Recent studies have shown that diabetes can be prevented, and the results are even greater with my patients over age 60. Losing a small amount of weight by getting some physical activity, 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier has proven to be effective. Listen to the great results from one of my patients.
I had to learn how to change my way of eating because diabetes ran in my family, and I wanted to take control of it before I got it.
Having diabetes in your family and being overweight puts you at a higher risk for type 2 diabetes. These risks increase with age, which is why it is important to take your first step today.
There was a time I could not go from my basement up to my bedroom, but now I can, and that means a lot to me.
It's not too late to prevent diabetes. Join my patients who are taking small steps and gaining big rewards.
For more information on how to prevent type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
Cancer survivorship, it's a topic that you really don't hear a whole lot about. And that's interesting in itself because more and more people are surviving cancer. It's not a death sentence anymore. In many cases, it's a life sentence. You might be surprised to know that here at the National Institutes of Health, we actually have an Office of Cancer Survivorship. And with us right now here on NIH Research Radio is the director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Julia Rowland. Thank you for joining us today.
Bill, it's lovely to be here today, and I really welcome the opportunity.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, about what the mission is at the Office of Cancer Survivorship.
Well, the ultimate goal of the office is really to enhance the length and quality of survival of all of those who carry a diagnosis of cancer.
I know when you hear about people that survive some horrible event, you hear about the guilt of survivorship. Does that enter into cancer survivorship at all?
That's certainly an issue for many individuals who carry this history. You know, why me? Why did I do well? Why did I recover from this? Why am I still here when there are so many others like me who have succumbed to this disease? So certainly there is an issue of that. And along with it, of course, is the fear that many survivors tell us they live with on a day-to-day basis, and that's that the disease will come back.
Do you ever get over that?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I guess the in general, people will tell you it never really goes away. But many people find they can park it somewhere and get on with their lives and live full, rich, and rewarding existences. For some, though, it's a real hurdle. It daily reminders, and certainly we've seen a lot of stories in the press lately about public figures talking about their illness coming back. And when those events occur, that raises a lot of anxiety in people who are survivors themselves.
How did the National Cancer Institute come about the decision to start this Office of Cancer Survivorship?
Well, the office was actually established back in 1996 in direct response to compelling and articulate response out of the advocacy community saying it's wonderful you have all of these advances, the earlier detection, better treatments, more supportive care, and that more people are living long-term with this illness. But what we don't know is to what you're returning individuals. What are the kinds of problems that individuals face after treatment, and what are you doing about that? Essentially, it was a challenge back to the NCI to say, congratulations on your success, but you need to be cognizant that cancer cures and care come with a cost.
And what got you interested in this particular field?
Well, I actually stumbled into this area in some ways in my graduate career. I was doing research in developmental psychology, so I was very interested in illnesses that occurs across the life course, when in a time of an individual's life do they become ill. And one of my professors referred me to a physician who was doing research at that time up in the Bronx looking at women who are breast cancer survivors and talking to them about their quality of life. And I was instantly hooked. I thought this was a fascinating area and lots of work to be done.
What is on the horizon in the realm of cancer survivorship? What research are you guys doing? What are some of the exciting things we're going to be hearing about in the near future?
Well, I think some of the exciting things that we're beginning to look at, partly it goes back to the mission of the office, which is tell us a little bit more about what happens to individuals post-treatment. So what has happened in the last 10 years since the office was created was that the medical community now recognizes that cancer survivorship, that post-treatment period, is an area of unique issues in and of itself. And that's very exciting because it's now placed this solidly on what we sometimes refer to as the cancer control continuum. Has its own unique issues, and there are researchers and clinicians who are addressing specifically that particular piece of recovery and wellness. What's been very exciting is as we listen to the voice of survivors, recognizing that we need to attend to their health behaviors after cancer, and that interestingly, some relatively simple kinds of things, recommendation to stay physically active after your cancer diagnosis, may have important impact on disease recurrence and possibly long-term survival. So those kinds of findings are very provocative, very exciting, because this is something everybody could do.
And this goes beyond the cancer patient, him or herself. This is everybody who knows and loves the cancer patient.
Absolutely. Back in 1986, a group of about 24 individuals gathered in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and created what is now known as the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship. And when they did that at the time, and they looked at how a survivor was essentially labeled in that earlier period, the medical definition for a survivor was someone who had remained 5 years disease-free. And in their wisdom, they said, this is no longer acceptable because you can't not be thinking about the quality of life issues for 5 years. You can't decide 5 years later, gee, I would have liked to have had kids.
You're thinking about those every day.
Absolutely. Mm. And they need to be part of the decision-making in your care. And when they decided that they needed to change that definition, it was the coalition that gave us the language that we use now for survivors, that anybody who is diagnosed with cancer may refer to him or herself as a cancer survivor from the moment of diagnosis.
From day one.
Day one, for the balance of their lives, whether they want to call themselves a survivor or not, but they're entitled to that. And there was two important messages they want to convey. Hope, you have a life, you have the opportunity to think about a life after cancer. As you said, we're turning these in more and more into either curable diseases or more often chronic illnesses that you can live long-term with. included under that larger umbrella, were family members and caregivers, because they recognize they're part of this journey and often an integral part of it.
Well, I know as a person with a chronic condition myself, and the listeners to this podcast know that I have Parkinson's disease and have been going through some clinical trial surgery for that. If you're not careful, you tend to think of everything that happens in your life in terms of the disease. How do you convey to a cancer survivor that there's more to you than the fact that you had cancer?
That's a really important point, Bill. And you know, as you talk about your own experience with Parkinson's disease, cancer survivors will tell you, well, you know, after this diagnosis and treatment, a headache is no longer a headache. It's mm-hmm. metastatic brain tumor, or you know, this is what you worry about. And that's part of the territory. It's we talked earlier about fear of recurrence. It's trying to find some place to park that worry and but get on with your life. And that's, you know, one of the challenges that individuals must, you know, deal with and, you know, find some comfortable resolution around if they're going to move forward.
We hear so much about the fight to research causes of cancer, the research for new treatments, preventions. We don't really hear enough, I think, about what to do when you've had cancer and what to do afterwards. And that's why I think that this is a very valuable discussion we're having today. What are some of the web resources that are available for folks? Your own website, for instance.
Absolutely. Our website, so the URL for that is www.survivorship.cancer.gov. Again, www.survivorship.cancer.gov, where you can come and find out the kind of research that we're supporting with public dollars here in the United States. Very, you know, cutting-edge research here. We also have on that site links to major reports that have come out. There have been, in the last 5 years, five major reports addressing the issues of cancer survivorship. So this is an issue that's really garnered public attention. People are excited about it. And these major reports, we're hoping, are going to stimulate not only more attention to, but obviously more funding for this kind of research and answers to those very questions that you've posed.
Anything else you want to add before we wrap it up?
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about language, and many people don't like to label themselves as a survivor.
Some people don't even like to say the word cancer,
right,
as if saying the word will make that tumor start to grow again.
Absolutely. And I think that certainly when the coalition adopted that language, it was not their intent to, quote unquote, label people, but rather to change the culture around care, to take away the stigma of having the disease, but also to say there's a lot of hope here involved and that people can lead very satisfying and productive lives after cancer. An important take-home message is that once you have had a cancer diagnosis, it is important to ask about what you can be doing to promote and maintain your health after these illnesses and treatments.
A patient is his or her own best advocate in this case.
Absolutely, and needs to be actively engaged in that, knowledgeable about it, asking those questions, what can I do, what do I need to know, how do I promote and ensure my health going forward.
A lot of reason to be optimistic, it sounds like.
Absolutely. 10.8 million survivors in the United States alone today, a very promising figure.
Well, thanks for being with us today and for sharing some of that optimism with us. Dr. Julia Rowland, Director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute, thanks for spending a few minutes with us today on NIH Research Radio.
My pleasure, Bill.
When we come back, Wally Akinso has a story about a surprising study concerning preterm birth. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Have the key.
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Who has a higher risk of preterm delivery? women with high cholesterol levels or women with low cholesterol? Wally Akinso has the story.
Pregnant women who have very low cholesterol levels may face a greater risk of delivering their babies prematurely than women with regular cholesterol levels, according to a study by the National Human Genome Research Institute. The study was published in the October issue of the journal Pediatrics, and although it confirms previous findings that very high levels of maternal cholesterol can increase the risk of premature birth, a surprising twist in the current study shows that low maternal cholesterol levels also may lead to adverse outcomes, according to Dr. Max Monka, the study's senior author.
The interesting finding was, and we were very surprised about this, that women who had very low cholesterol had babies that were born too early. The most interesting finding in this was that we found this significant fourfold increase in premature birth only in white women and not in African American women. What we could confirm in our study was that women who have high cholesterol, that they also have babies born prematurely, but this was already known before we started our study.
In the study of 1,058 South Carolina women and their newborns, researchers found about 5% of women with cholesterol levels in the moderate range of 159 to 261 milligrams per deciliter gave birth prematurely. But between white and African American women, there was a difference in the rates of premature births, which Dr. Monka discusses.
What we found was in healthy white and healthy African American women at ages between 21 and 34, we found that in both groups, women who had low cholesterol had babies born who were with a lower birth weight. What was different in both groups was that among white women, babies were born earlier, that is, born before 37 weeks, whereas African American women, we did not find this. At this point, we do not know where this difference comes from, and this is something we would like to explore in future studies.
Premature birth is a major cause of infant death and raises the risk of many potential disabling conditions, including cerebral palsy, cognitive impairment, blindness, deafness, and respiratory illness. Dr. Monka said in light of these findings, researchers have a renewed drive to establish the genetic and environmental causes of low cholesterol levels because of its relevance to pregnancy. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Extremely low birth weight premature babies who received breast milk shortly after birth had greater mental development scores at 30 months than did infants who were not fed breast milk, according to a study funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the National Institutes of Health. What's more, babies fed breast milk were less likely to be rehospitalized after their initial discharge than the babies who were not fed breast milk. This study is a follow-up to a previous study, according to Dr. Rosemary Higgins, program officer with the Pregnancy and Perinatology Branch at the NICHD.
We had one study in this population looking at these children at 18 months that showed the breastfed babies had developmental gains at that point in time. However, some of the information gained at 18 months is not always translatable to older children. So we then got these children back at age 30 months, and the gain persisted in their mean developmental index.
Researchers have long known the benefits of breast milk for full-term infants, but the potential effects in preterm babies had not been well studied, according to Dr. Higgins.
There's natural substances in breast milk that are very beneficial. There are several that are known. However, key factors that contribute overall are still not clear, and no one has been able to reproduce this in formula.
Researchers speculated that nutrients present in breast milk might foster brain development. The study appeared in the October 1st issue of Pediatrics. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us Friday, October 19th, when episode 43 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website. That's www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the Health Star Radio Network, and online at www.federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. That email address, ws159h@nih.gov. One more time, that email address is ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.